Committee on Tax Reform, a division of the Senate Committee on Taxes, will come to order. We have not yet established a quorum. We have a long agenda, however, so we're going to begin with Senate File 2918. When we establish a quorum, we will we have a quorum. Senator Pappas, welcome to the committee. We have Senate File 2918, and we have the A2 amendment. It's an author's amendment. Senator Eaton moves the author's amendment, the A2. Thank you. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Pappas, please present your bill, and if you could be brief. Again, we have a very long agenda.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. As members probably know, we're hosting the National Conference of State Legislators next August. And typically, the NCSL, because it's an instrumentality of the states, is tax-exempt, and that language needed to be clarified in our statute. So we thought we had a letter from the IRS that approved it, but it turns out that the revenue and Senate lawyers decided we needed to pass a bill. So that's why I'm here before you.
Well, Senator Pappas, this is a matter of wearing both a belt and suspenders, correct?
Right. This is money that we have to raise to host NCSL, so this will be a little bit less money that we have to raise to give back to ourselves.
But what I mean by that is that we had assumed that it was understood, but now we have to put a clarification in the law to make sure that there are no bumps in the road.
That's correct, Madam Chair. We anticipate this would save the NCSL host committee about $35,000.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Is there anyone who wants to testify on this bill? We adopted it.
Madam Chair, I didn't bring any testifiers.
I understand. Ma'am, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
My name is Mary O'Connor from Brooklyn Center.
Thank you.
Taxes should be fair. This proposal says that government should not pay these sales taxes. And local governments don't have to pay sales taxes, but individuals do. Some businesses don't have to pay sales taxes. Others do. Either no one should pay sales taxes or everyone should. I recommend the 6.5% Minnesota sales tax be eliminated. To make up for this tax revenue loss, I suggest that almost all tax credits, refunds, and deductions be eliminated. Income tax rates and the corporate tax rate should increase moderately. Taxes should be fair and simple. Now they are unfair and way too complicated. I offer you my written suggestions, and I would be happy to help you make taxes fair and simple for everyone. And I noticed in looking at this booklet, this tax booklet, that United Healthcare doesn't pay any insurance company tax because they don't sell insurance in Minnesota. So what taxes does big United Healthcare pay for Minnesota? And I have handouts. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Connor. And if the page will get the handouts for the committee members. Anyone else like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Senator Eaton moves that Senate File 2918 as amended be laid over for further consideration. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Pappas. Usually we just lay over the bills, but I kind of got in a roll there, so it works the same way. Senator Skoy.
Thank you.
Senator Skoy brings us Senate File 2910. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And Senate File 2910 is a result of a couple of actions that occurred last session. These are provisions that the Senate was not supportive of and was not included in our bill, but as a result of conference committee negotiations became part of law. I think that it would be good for the Senate to have an opportunity to have the Senate Tax Committee to have an opportunity about these. This bill does two things. It would propose to remove the indexing that's on the cigarette tax rate. Senate Tax Committee last year had a pretty strong policy about indexing. We didn't index the LGA formula. We didn't index other provisions that we were working on last year. I think that we should contemplate removing indexing on cigarettes. The other provision in this law deals with little cigars. For those of you that were part of the discussion about the little cigars, we recall that the discussion revolved around taxing little cigars the same as cigarettes. We heard that over and over and over again. Nobody was proposing that little cigars be taxed at twice the rate of cigarettes. Because of an anomaly in the cigarette law dealing with the weight, as they were impacted with longer cigarettes during the earlier time, the little cigars ended up paying twice the tax that cigarettes did. And I would propose that we would change that so that little cigars and cigarettes would be taxed at the same rate. And hence, my initiative here was Senate File Number 2910.
Any questions for Senator Skoy before we go to testimony? Senator Skoy, did you have any author's amendments?
No, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Skoy. I have a Mr. Bryant, Tom Bryant. Welcome to the committee. If you would state your name for the record and give your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Bryant, and I am the executive director of two trade associations, the Minnesota Wholesale Marketers Association, a tobacco wholesale association here in the state, and the National Association of Tobacco Outlets, a national convenience store and tobacco store trade association with member stores here in Minnesota. I'm testifying in support of Senate File 2910. As Senator Skoy indicated, Section 1 changes the cigarette tax rate on little cigars. Some little cigars weigh more than 3 pounds per thousand. Some little cigars do not, but it's those heavier little cigars that are taxed at the higher rate. So this equalizes the tax rate on all little cigars and cigarettes. Because the doubling of that tax rate to $5.66 a pack of little cigars has effectively eliminated all the sales of those heavier little cigars in the state of Minnesota. Also, Section 2 of the bill would repeal the automatic indexing of the cigarette tax rate. Minnesota is currently the only state with such an indexing adjustment factor on cigarettes. For the first 6 months of the current fiscal year, bordering states, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin, have gained 6.3 million tax-paid cigarette pack sales. And I have the data that I'll provide to the committee here. None of those bordering states changed their cigarette tax rates like Minnesota did last year. However, that 6.3 million in cross-border sales in the other states accounts for a $50 million retail loss in cigarettes, because cigarettes on average cost about $8 per pack. So primarily as a result of the tax increase in Minnesota on cigarettes, retailers have lost $50 million in sales of cigarettes the past 6 months. Future increases in the Minnesota cigarette tax rate based on the indexing will only exacerbate that loss, and it's difficult enough now to remain in business and retain jobs to have another automatic increase in the cigarette tax rate each year. Two tobacco economists, Orzechowski and Walker, they published the tax burden on tobacco. They have provided me with the data from all of the neighboring states with their tax-paid cigarette sales from July 1 and from the current year to show the increase that they've had for the first 6 months of fiscal year 14. And I've summarized that here in a chart for the committee. If there would be a page that could help me. Madam Chair, that concludes my testimony. We urge you to support Senate File 2910.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bryant. Questions for Senator Skoy or Mr. Bryant? Senator Gozelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, do you have the revenue numbers for Minnesota with the tax increase? I mean, you talked about the bordering states gaining $6.3 million. You know, our revenue from tobacco taxes, did they also go up?
Madam Chair, Senator Gozelka.
I think it's on the handout, Senator Gozelka. But Mr. Bryant, go ahead.
Yes, the state has approximately $31 million in excess over projections for the first 7 months of the current fiscal year, according to Department of Revenue figures. Yes.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I just want to comment, too. I appreciate the bill coming forward. I don't think we should do anything on autopilot, and I'm glad we're taking a look at this.
Any other testifiers or any questions for Senator Skoy or Mr. Bryant? Senator Eden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't necessarily have a question. I have a comment.
That's
that the retailers may have lost $50 million, but potentially Minnesota can save $1.65 billion in health care costs, that 36,000 Minnesotans have tried to quit smoking, and we have the potential of 47,000 Minnesota kids prevented from starting and becoming addicted to cigarettes. I don't think that smoking cigarettes or decreasing the cost of cigarettes to encourage people to smoke and buy them in Minnesota is an advantage at all to anybody in the state.
Thank you, Senator Eden. Any other comments or questions from the members? Any other testimony? Seeing none, Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Just very briefly before we end up, I'm not questioning the impact of last year's law or rate change. I just think that it's appropriate that we take a look at indexing. I think it's appropriate that the legislature take a look at these things for effectiveness and whether their impacts are appropriate in doing what we would like to do with regard to the little cigars. I don't think anybody expected the tax rate to double. Nobody testified to that. I think it's appropriate that we take a look at that also. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Skoy. There being no further discussion, the chair lays over Senate File 2910 for further consideration.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay, Senate File 2848, Senator Eakin, are you here? Senator Bonhoff, I understand you're waiting for a testifier, is that correct?
Still waiting, yes.
Still waiting. Senator Dietzig, are you prepared at this point? Okay. Senator Dietzig presents Senate File 2685. Senator Bonhoff, we're going to take Senator Dietzig's bill first, okay, and then we'll come right back to you. Senator Dietzig, go ahead. And is Senator Clausen here yet? Or Senator Chamberlain? Go ahead. Senator Dietzig presents Senate File 2685.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members.
And there's an author's amendment.
Yes.
The
E2.
Senator Dietzig moves the
A2.
A2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Dietzig.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Current law allows certain health care providers and hospitals to claim a research credit up to 2.5% of revenue from patient services to fund qualifying research. The credit is capped at around $2.5 million a year. Senate File 2685 extends the research credit to include research conducted in coordination with a public or private higher education institution for treating eating disorders. In the United States, around 20 million women and 10 million men suffer from clinically significant eating disorders at some time in their life. The average age of onset is about 19 years old. I could not find current health care costs for treating eating disorders in Minnesota, and I also could not find information on the broader costs of eating disorders, including lost productivity for the sick person and their caregiver. Many believe these costs are substantial. Early diagnosis and appropriate cost-effective treatment will help patients and reduce the broad economic burden. More research is needed to help find treatment so people can lead productive lives. Senate File 2685 will help fund needed research. This is an existing credit, not a new credit. The bill simply amends who can qualify to take advantage of the credit. With me today is Ms. Lindsay Drebenstedt from the MLA program to discuss the idea. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Senator Dietzick. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Drevenstedt, if you would identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for the opportunity to speak this morning. My name is Lindsay Drevenstedt, and I'm a senior director at the EMILY program, Eating Disorder Treatment Centers. As you heard from Senator Dietzick in her introduction of the Minnesota Care Tax Eating Disorder Research Credit.
Could you bring the microphone closer to you, please?
Sorry,
thank
I'm a little
you.
Quiet
and
there.
Maybe speak a little bit
is
louder.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, great.
If you turn it up a little bit, I think it'd be the top thing. That, there you go. Thank you
All
very
right.
much.
Sorry about that. As you heard from Senator Dietzick in her introduction of the Minnesota Care Tax Eating Disorder Research Credit, eating disorders are serious and life-threatening illnesses. The EMILY program not only provides treatment to individuals suffering from eating disorders, we also contribute significantly to research, seeking to advance knowledge in the field of eating disorders and better understand what constitutes effective treatment. The EMILY program conducts between 8 and 12 studies annually in conjunction with the University of Minnesota Departments of Psychiatry and Nutrition and other institutions of higher education. These studies are not a routine evaluation of healthcare methods. Rather, this research advances the field of eating disorders, generates evidence contributing to prevention, assessment, treatment design, and implementation. The EMILY program financially supports these studies with a research coordinator, research assistants, as well as supporting the time of clinician investigators to conduct research. In addition to the University of Minnesota, the EMILY program also conducts studies with students and faculty of the University of St. Thomas, St. Mary's University, and Argosy University. Three nationally recognized experts in eating disorder treatment and research are employed by the EMILY program. They include Dr. Scott Crowe, Dr. Carol Peterson, and Dr. Jillian Lampert. Each is also affiliated with the University of Minnesota. I'd like to provide three examples of some recently completed studies. One is experiences of commitment for eating disorder. Is commitment helpful? This was an interview-based study with individuals who had experienced the commitment process as a result of their serious eating disorder. The study was conducted in conjunction with Hennepin County and the U of M and resulted in improvements to Hennepin County's commitment process for people with eating disorders. The second is our yoga and body image study, which examined the impact of regular yoga practice on body image and self-concept in people with eating disorders. The study added to literature demonstrating effectiveness of yoga in all levels of eating disorder care and affirmed that yoga is a skill and a practice that individuals can also access after treatment in order to maintain treatment gains and help prevent relapse. The third is our DSM-5 field trial study, which was conducted by the EMILY program and the University of Minnesota. In this study, we helped shape the new diagnostic criteria for eating disorders recently released by the American Psychiatric Association. The study was the largest DSM-5 field trial study in the country examining the proposed new diagnostic criteria. All research conducted by the EMILY program in conjunction with the U of M is approved in writing by the EMILY program, the U of M Department of Psychiatry or Department of Nutrition, and the U of M Institutional Review Board or Institutional Review Board of another participating institute of higher education. All research is subject to review by the EMILY Program Research Committee, comprised of individuals who, with expertise in the subject matter of the proposed study, but who have no financial interest in the proposed study and are not involved in the conduct of the proposed study. All research is subject to review and supervision by the University of Minnesota Institutional Review Board and is conducted by the EMILY program in conjunction with the U of M for the purpose of developing new knowledge in eating disorder assessment, diagnosis, treatment, and prevention. For these reasons, we request passage of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Senator Dietzick? So, Senator Dietzick, research credit itself is not being expanded, just the opportunity to include a different field of research. Is that accurate?
Correct.
To apply for it.
Yes. We don't know who. There's about five. My understanding is there's about five entities that are using the credit or have applied for the credit in the past few years. It's staying at the $2.5 million or right around $2.5 million. We're not expanding that dollar amount. We're just expanding and allowing others, very narrowly tailored others, apply for this credit.
Senator Dietzick, have you had any conversations with members of Senator Sharon's or Senator Lurie's committee about the policy expansion here?
Madam Chair, I may have talked to Senator Sharon about this, and I've talked to the research staff
Okay.
about this.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Dietzick, would this be the first time that we're moving outside of what is currently the requirement that it be an allowable research program, which is kind of a, appears to me, kind of a broader definition of what would be eligible, and to specifically pointing out a disorder to qualify for the credit? And it must be that the purpose of treating eating disorders is not currently an allowable research program? Is that
Senator Skoy, I don't know if the other researchers are doing eating disorder research, but they are mostly involved in their hospitals or healthcare providers are who qualified before. We're just tying it to, because they are involved with the university, we're getting them into through the university. So the hospitals might be doing eating disorder research. They're just who can qualify for this right now is certain healthcare providers and hospitals. They are not a hospital, and they, I kind of looked at it and couldn't get an answer if they would be considered a healthcare provider. So we, it does talk about being tied to a government entity, and so we are tying them to the, you know, a public or private university. So again, trying to narrowly tailor who can apply for this.
Oh, I see what's going on. Okay.
Yeah, so we don't know from, I mean, it's kind of like the Angel Investment Tax Credit. We don't know who is, thank you, Madam Chair, sorry. We don't know who has actually applied for the credit in the past, and so one of the other five people may be doing eating disorder research. We just don't know that. I don't know that. So we don't know what they're using it for, but we know there's about five that have applied.
Okay, thank
God, Senator Skoy, too. It would seem to me that eating disorders certainly come under the category of, you know, positive mental health, and it's an appropriate study. It's not just a physiological thing. It's trying to promote good mental health as well.
Yes, Madam Chair, when I was doing the research, I mentioned in my statement that we couldn't find current health care costs. There is a bill in the U.S. Senate that's looking at doing the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House that's looking at doing and finding the economic impact of eating disorders, because it does start, the average onset is age 19, so it gets people right when they're at college age and starting their work life, and so you have that lost productivity, you know, throughout their life and then their caregivers. In Germany and in England, they've done some studies, and it's about $1.7 billion U.S. dollars is the impact and just the lost productivity. They have one of the highest, if not one of the highest, mortality rates, people that have eating disorders, and so it is truly a disease that we're just trying to find a way to help.
Okay. Is there further discussion from members? Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify on Senate File 2685? Seeing none, the chair lays over Senate File 2685 as amended. Next bill, actually, I think I'm going to take Senator Bonoff. She's ready, and then we'll come back to Senator Eakin. Senator Bonoff, Senate File 2488. All your testifiers are here. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. They actually were here, and we didn't know each other, so we're all here.
Well, good. I'm glad they've taken care of that.
Yes.
Senate File 2488, and I understand there's an author's amendment, the A1.
Yes,
and,
Madam Chair.
The revenue estimate is drawn to the A1 amendment. Senator Coonan moves the A1 amendment on behalf of the author. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As the committee is aware, the research tax credit allows a business to deduct 10% of the first $2 million spent on research expenditures and 2.5% of expenditures in excess of $2 million. Prior to 2010, this credit only applied for businesses operating as C Corp. In 2010, it was extended to include the pass-through entities, the S-Corps, partnerships, and LLCs. Senate File 2488 would extend the research credit to businesses operating as sole proprietorships. As you can see from the enclosed fiscal note, we do not expect that this would be a large group of businesses that this would impact, yet certainly an important sector. And so I am joined today by two business people who would like to speak on behalf of it, as well as Genevieve from Life Science Alley. Before I do that, I'll just quickly go to the bill itself and review that. Section 1 extends the credit to businesses operating as sole proprietorships, and the amendment extends the time for filing amended returns to April 15th of 2015 for individuals who would now qualify. And so, in essence, it is the to pick up the time frame by which they weren't qualified to make it retroactive, so that the those who would now be covered would be covered the same time as the S-Corps have been in the LLCs.
And Senator Bonhoff, the credit is also refundable, is that correct?
Madam Chair, the that's in a separate bill. This bill treats the R&D credit.
I'm sorry, I was from years 2010 through 2012 was when the credit was refundable. The House bill last year made it non-refundable.
Yes, so, exactly.
That's an open issue. Okay, I see now. Sorry.
Thank you.
Who would like to go first?
Mr. Gross.
Mr. Gross, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Mark Gross, and I'm the sole proprietor of Former Code LLC. It is an LLC, but I own it myself, and I own a real company. It does real research and development. Former Code is 12 years old, self-funded, bootstrap, organically grown. I have 10 employees, payroll of $500,000, we have lived and died by our research and development work. Some of the research and development we've done since 2010 failed, just like R&D really does do fail sometimes, and we lost 80% of our revenue by failing to be able to maintain the next generation of product for one of our...
You need to talk to the
talk closer.
Investors in Tesla, however.
Yes. right. Well, we're not alone.
Right.
So we lost 80% of our revenue from one customer because we couldn't advance to the next generation with the technologies that we were developing. At the same time, though, we exist today because the research and development that we did during that same time and replaced that 80% of our revenue with a whole new batch of customers, new products, and capabilities based on that. In 2010 and 2011, I applied for the research and development credits and received them as a sole proprietor. In 2012, I was denied as a disregarded entity, and which makes me really nervous to say this because I hate somebody to come back and say, well, you owe this money. But I feel compelled to just point out that it seems unevenly applied, and this bill would correct that.
Mr. Gross, where is your business located?
Savage.
In Savage. Okay, thank you very much. Any questions or comments for Mr. Gross? Senator Gazzolka.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Gross, the sole proprietor, is that typically because that's in the startup phase, or do some of the companies you're talking about stay as sole proprietor always? I'm just thinking about some of the reasons why I wouldn't do that, but I just want to understand that.
You know,
Mr. Gross.
Yes, at the time.
Mr. Gross, our custom is to direct your, for the tape, to direct your comments through the chair. So,
my
Mr.
Apologies.
Gross, that's okay.
Madam Chair.
Yes, now Senator Gazelle.
Really, it's just that an LLC is quick, fast, easy, and effective. And as a sole proprietor, it's all easy. I don't have to have special meetings and long whatever they are.
I get it. All right.
That's all. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gazelka. Thank you, Mr. Groves. Who's next?
Actually, Madam Chair, Mr. Schmidt's going to save his testimony and incorporate it into the next bill.
That's fine. Ms. Plumador.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. We just want to
You need to identify yourself.
Genevieve Plumador with Life Science Alley. I'm here in support of both of Senator Bonoff's bills, and I'll just speak briefly on 2488. Given the size and scope of the life science community here in Minnesota and the network of life science companies that we have, we understand that there is real R&D happening in companies such as Mr. Gross's and even at the sole proprietor level, and so we are supportive of the change in 2488.
Thank you. Are there further questions or comments for Senator Bonoff or her witnesses? I understand that this provision has been so far included in the House second tax bill. Is that correct, Senator Bonoff?
Yes, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to underscore a value that I believe this committee has endorsed, and that is clarity around the tax code. And so Mr. Gross, in telling that story about getting the R&D credit and then losing it, it really was a risk to share that publicly. But I think it does highlight that nothing changed. What changed was the interpretation, which reveals that it really isn't very clear.
Okay. Any further questions? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Bonoff, I appreciate your coming forward with this. I don't think we should be discriminating against sole proprietors. Actually, the sole proprietor is taking a lot more risk because they're personally liable for their business. Where limited liability, you have reduced that individual liability. So we certainly don't want to be discouraging people from being a sole proprietor.
Madam Chair,
so Senator
Skoy, thank you very
much. You're receiving a favorable, making a favorable impression on this committee as well.
Thank you.
There being no further discussion, is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, the chair lays over Senate File 2488, and we'll take up as amended, and we'll take up Senate File 2489. And there's also an author's amendment for that. Senator Coonan moves the. What's the amendment?
A1.
Moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We have before us Senate File 2489 as amended. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill before you makes the R&D credit refundable. Through 2009, this tax credit was non-refundable and only allowed against the corporate franchise tax. However, in 2010, the credit was extended to pass-through entities, and it was made refundable. However, in 2013, it was once again made non-refundable. Senate File 2489 would make this credit refundable once again. The A1 amendment then provides additional instructions the Department of Revenue would need to compute the carryover for the research credit, because the way the bill is drafted, the enacting of the refundable would be the beginning of 2014, and so you would have to put back in the statute how to calculate the carry forward non-refundable portion for the years when it wasn't refundable. It's a very straightforward bill.
Thank you, Senator Bonoff. It also has a very expensive price tag.
But, Madam Chair, unfortunately, that is the case.
There you go.
There you go.
The testimony on this bill, who would like to begin?
I'll go. Good morning, Madam Chair and Committee. Thank you for allowing me to speak this morning. My name is Scott Schmidt, and I am the owner or part owner of two businesses that have interest in the R&D tax credit. One is a small software development company that up until 2013 had been benefiting from the refundable aspect of the Minnesota State R&D tax credit. The company does not have tax liabilities, and so therefore the cash from our R&D tax or from our R&D activities was helpful. The other business is a consulting business that focuses solely on helping companies across the country take advantage of the R&D tax credit. So we are practitioners that help companies benefit from the R&D tax credit. So this morning, because we have Mark, who I kind of joke is kind of the poster child for both of these bills, I'm going to talk more as a practitioner who works with credits across the country. As you know, Minnesota is the first state in the country to have a state R&D tax credit. Over time, many states implemented R&D tax credits, and today just a little under 40 states across the country do have state R&D tax credits. Over time, while we were the first state to have a credit, over time, as more states implemented credits, our credit became very average. It was an okay credit. As you know, in 2010, Minnesota took some significant steps to greatly enhance the credit, doubled the value, made it available to almost all entities, and made it refundable. Through that strengthening of the credit in 2010, the Minnesota credit rocketed right up to the top of the charts as one of the best state credits in the country, without a doubt. And again, we're a practitioner. We work with companies all across the country, and we see all the credits. I know what's out there. And ours was absolutely one of the best in the country because of the refundable aspect of it. Then, as you know, the refundable aspect went away, and the Minnesota credit went from the top of the charts now down to very average at best again. It's an okay credit as you compare to other states in the country. And so what I would like to ask of the committee is to consider making the Minnesota credit one of the best credits in the country again by reinstating that refundable aspect to the Minnesota state credit.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Any questions for Senator Bonhoeff or Mr. Schmidt so far? Okay, Ms. Plumador, now would you like to testify?
Madam Chair, I apologize.
It's okay.
I just wanted to add on Mark's behalf, and back to the first bill, because we are practitioners, I know there's estimates of if you make the Minnesota credit available to sole proprietors, I know there's estimates on what that would mean to the state. I will tell you, as a practitioner, we see very, very few sole proprietors today. Most companies are S-corps. Mm-hmm. We see C-corporations. We see very, very few sole proprietors. So I don't know if the estimates are correct or not, but I'm pretty confident that whatever the number would be is a very, very minute impact to the budget. And I will also say that even though Mark is a sole proprietor, he absolutely is doing the same type of R&D that all the other medical device and technology companies are doing. Because he's a sole proprietor does not imply he's not doing R&D. He is doing R&D and has activities that meet the definition of R&D. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and I would direct members' attention to the revenue analysis detail for the assumptions that go into their estimate on Senate File 2488, and they do acknowledge that part of their analysis is based on unknown factors, but they make some assumptions about the growth and its use and so on, and that. And as you know, we are we don't do dynamic scoring at all, and we do have to abide by the Department of Revenue's number. Sometimes we argue with them about that, but we seldom prevail, I must say.
And I'll also add, sure. Madam Chair, sorry, I'm going to keep working on this. Just as a lot of people did not know that sole proprietors were not eligible for the R&D tax credit, because we thought everybody was now eligible as of 2010. I would suspect that if this change takes place, the bill moves forward and passes, and you now make sole proprietors eligible for the Minnesota credit, I'm going to guess, just based on experience, that a lot of the sole proprietors are not going to know they're eligible.
Then, Mr. Schmidt, it's up to you to let them know.
Thank you. I accept the challenge.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Genevieve Plumendor again with Life Science Alley. So again, here in support of 2489, Life Science Alley is supportive of returning to refundability. As you know, our companies are heavy in the med tech and the medical device area, which is heavy in R&D. This was a mechanism that provided Minnesota an opportunity to be competitive and attract a lot of attention nationwide, as Mr. Schmidt had said. I did provide the committee with a handout of the 10 other places that we are in competition with in the med tech space and in the space where my companies play in. So if you look at the amounts, we are on the low end of the spectrum, and without the refundability component, we are, again, just an average credit, as Mr. Schmidt had pointed out.
Excuse me, just one second. There's no attribution on the handout, but we'll note that it does come from LifeSound. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as you know, the pathway to profitability for our companies and for success in our companies are a lot different than some of the others due to the FDA timelines and the R&D timelines. It can take anywhere from 5 to 10 years until these companies see a profit. And with the refundability component, it brings in an influx of capital immediately to those small early stage companies and is helping to grow entrepreneurship here in Minnesota. At the end of last year, Life Science Alley came out with a report that showed that in 2010, there was $217 million invested in early-stage life science companies here in Minnesota. And by 2013, there was an increase to $314 million, a trend that hasn't been seen in any other state in the country. And we attribute it a lot to the Angel Investment Tax Credit, to the refundability component of the R&D tax credit. And again, this maturation of entrepreneurship is something that Minnesota has always been known for, and we hope that the committee will consider bringing in this component again so that we can, again, be on top for the early stage development here in Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Plumendor. Any questions? Mr. Gross, would you like to also testify on this bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I just want to say that in 2010 and 11, when former Coat did receive refundable tax credit for research and development, it was very helpful. 2012, where it was denied, and it was a much more difficult year. And so the refundable part really was helpful. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify, Mr. Carnival? Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doug Carnival, representing the Minnesota High Tech Association. I just want to also lend our support to this bill, and everything I was going to say has already been said. So,
Mr. Carnival, but what about the previous bill? Do you all support that as well?
We do, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Is there further testimony on Senate File 2489? Seeing none, Senator Bonoff, final comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was very pleased with the work of this committee with regard to the Angel Investment Tax Credit. I think putting that in our first tax bill really sent a strong signal to how important we think it is to remain economically competitive and to make sure we're poised to lead the nation coming out of this recovery, which I believe we are when you look at our numbers. And so I think I know this is expensive. I don't know whether or not it'll fit within your overall framework, but I think looking at this is very important in terms of putting together a package that continues to allow Minnesota to be at the top of that pack. We hear a lot about Austin, Texas. You know what's happening in California. I think that we are still poised, if we continue to make these kinds of changes in our policies, to be an oasis in the Midwest and to lead in this way. So I would urge the committee to give it strong consideration. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Question for council. This proposal is scalable, is it not?
Madam Chair, yes, I believe so. One option that may come to mind would be to make a portion of the credit refundable and then the rest of the portion available for the carry forward that's under current law. Madam Chair, but I'd like to look into that a little further.
Sure. Maybe we'll explore that. Is there anything else? Seeing none, the chair lays over Senate File 2489 as amended. Thank you very much. Senator Bonhoff and Mr. Schmidt and Mr. Gross.
Thank you.
The next bill is Senator Eakin, going back to number 4 on the agenda, Senate File 2848. Senator Eakin has an amendment, author's amendment. Senator Coonan moves adoption of the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We have Senate File 2848 as amended before us. Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill addresses the internship program bill that we had passed last year, some minor fixes here to that bill. The Greater Minnesota Internship Credit became law last year, providing a tax credit of up to $2,000 to Greater Minnesota employers who create internships and hire students from Minnesota colleges and universities from the MinSCU system as interns. And the premise of this legislation was to show young people that there were great career opportunities outside of the metropolitan area to connect businesses and college students in Greater Minnesota, to provide valuable practical experience for those students in their educational career, to help students find good jobs after they graduate, and to help businesses in Greater Minnesota find good employees. It would be a win-win for Greater Minnesota, really, and helping to address some of the problems of losing many of our young people. There's a real outflow from that area, and this would help to stop or slow that down and stabilize the economy in Greater Minnesota. Over the last year, the Greater Minnesota Partnership, MinSCU, and the Office of Higher Education have worked on a few adjustments to the program in order to make it more usable for students and businesses, as well as making it easier for the office to administer. The first change is in the length of the internship. Originally, we had 12 weeks to match the length of the semester, but in working with individual schools, we have found that 8 weeks is really the proper length of an internship for class credit. There's the summer programs, internships that last 8 weeks, and there's 8-week programs during the regular school year as well. The next change is simply to allow graduate students to use the program. That was always our intent, but we heard from some businesses that there was some ambiguity here, so we just simply clarified that this is open to graduate students and to graduate programs. So we just cleaned up that language. The final change, which was part of the author's amendment that was just passed, was to strike the language on lines 2.7 and 2.8, and the Office of Higher Education felt that this was not a standard that could be met. Again, it was too vague. If a student is majoring in communications and goes to intern in a law office, for instance, it's not clear if that is related, and that's what the language says, that the internship would have to be related to what they're majoring in. And even if the student was going to go to law school, they wouldn't be able to ascertain whether it's related. So we just opened it up more, which I think is a good thing. And those are the major changes. I guess there's one other change at the very end is the date. They changed the date of reporting. The Department of it says here by February 1st, 2017, the Office of the Department of Revenue shall report to the legislature doing an analysis of the effectiveness of the program. We pushed that back partly because of these changes. The program, it's going, but it's not moving along as quickly as expected, partly because of some of the problems they ran into. And so we're trying to help speed it up now, and so hopefully we'll have a report then in 2017, and hopefully the program will be very effective. So with that, I stand for
trying to work through the program, and I understand that what you're doing as well as what Senator Dietzick is just changing some eligibility and so forth for the credit that's capped at $2 million. The employers must be in Greater Minnesota as defined. The institutions, is there can they be anywhere, or is it just where the employers are? So can an employer in Waseca offer a graduate internship to a student who lives in Minneapolis and goes to the University of Minnesota?
Madam Chair, that's a very good question, and it is the employers, where the employers are located.
So
where the
situs of the employer is what determines the eligibility, nothing else.
That is correct. Institution could be
not the institution,
metro.
and not where the student permanently resides.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Questions for Senator Eakin before we turn to his testifier, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Eakin, I have a soft place in my heart for Greater Minnesota, and so I like what you're doing. But I do have a question related to why we're only limited to Minnesota institutions, having four kids go part Minnesota colleges and part on someplace else. I want to get them back into rural Minnesota. But I'm just wondering what the thought process was there.
And Madam Chair, and Senator Gazelka, I think
Senator Eakin.
I think part of the issue was cost, obviously, and I do have Mr. Mike Miller here too from the Greater Minnesota Partnership, who could maybe address that a little bit further if you'd like.
Madam Chair, Senator Gazelka, I'm Mike Miller with the Greater Minnesota Partnership.
Mr. Miller.
Senator Gazelka, the reason we have it that way is because the Office of Higher Education administers the program. They administer it through the individual colleges. The relationships that the Office of Higher Education has with the colleges is through the state grant program. Obviously, if a college is outside of the state of Minnesota, it's not eligible for the students that attend that school are not eligible for a Minnesota state grant. We couldn't figure out a way to have the employers go to, say, North Dakota State to attract a student and still have the Office of Higher Education work with North Dakota State and make that all work. We couldn't figure out a way to make that work. The best way was to keep the lines of communication open using the state grant program's existing infrastructure.
It is the case, however, that it's available for students who are in both private and public institutions. I don't know for right now, but at some point, linking it to states with whom Minnesota enjoys a reciprocity agreement might be somewhere down the line to be able to accomplish that, Senator Gazelka. But I think right now that's not where we're at. We're trying to beef up the program in terms of who can take advantage of it, and acknowledging that most internships are maybe a lot of them are more than 8 weeks, but probably not too many of them are more than 12 weeks before a student has to return to the classroom. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Eakin, or maybe Mr. Miller. Do you have anything that you could add to the deletion of line on page 2, lines 7 and 8? And with the amendment, I'm expecting there might be some differences here than with the other body, and we might be having conversations about this. Is there any more you can add to help us in our future conversations on why we don't want the internship program to be related to their course of study? It seems to me that that would be a pretty good thing to be requiring.
Senator Eakin.
Madam Chair and Senator Scoy, we did have this discussion in the Higher Ed Committee on that very issue, and there were many who felt that it should be more open because people, students do change as far as what their career choices are, and that we should leave it open to them and that they'd be the best ones to make that determination as to what career path they would like to follow. And it was kind of difficult to determine what's related. The example that I gave, for instance, somebody who's in communications, there's kind of that gray area. How do you determine whether, working in law office is related to that or not? So we just felt it was best to leave it open to the students to make that determination.
Thank you.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with this in part because of what you were saying, but also you can have a communications graduate or student that's, you know, wants to go into communications because they can't figure out what else they want to do, and then they get hired by somebody in a STEM field because they need somebody to do some technical writing for them, and so that might get the person into technical writing or more into the STEM field. You could have, in the same sense, you could have somebody that's going into math or engineering that maybe a law firm is looking for somebody to do some research on a case, and so they're not technically related to the study, but I think it broadens their study and might help open other doors for them, because just because you're a communications major or an engineer or a, you know, a science major, math major, doesn't mean, I mean, sometimes they take different paths, and so so I think that's how I would say that, is I agree with that, because I think it's hard to pinpoint people.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, and Ms. Pollock just pointed out to me that on line 9, right underneath that, it does have to be academic credit, so that would probably provide the connection to the study work.
Further discussion or comments for Senator Eakin or his testifier? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, the chair lays over Senate File 2848 as amended. Thank you very much, Senator Eakin.
Madam Chair and members.
Senate File 1834, Senator Clausen. Okay. Welcome to the committee, Senator Clausen. Please present your bill. Senate File 1834.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. And Senate File 1834 is a tax deduction proposal for contributions to the Minnesota College Savings Plan.
Senator Clausen, could you bring the microphone closer and maybe speak a little louder, please? Thank you.
Thank you. Senate File 1834 is a tax deduction proposal for contributions to the Minnesota College Savings Plan, commonly referred to as a 529 College Savings Plan. Just a little bit of history on this. Last fall, Senator Boniff and I visited 22 college campuses around the state. We visited University of Minnesota campuses, community colleges, members of the Minnesota State College and University System, private nonprofits, and for-profit institutions as well. And at each campus, we conducted a listening session with students. And a topic that was voiced at each campus was the high cost of education and the resulting debt. Currently, Minnesota four-year graduates carry the third highest amount of debt in the country at $30,000, and our state also has the fifth highest percentage of students with education-related debt at 71%. A 529 college savings plan allows parents, grandparents, or students themselves to save for college costs. The Minnesota plan is operated by the Office of Higher Education and was created by the state to encourage individuals to save for post-secondary education. Earnings in the plan accrue free of Minnesota income tax, and qualified withdrawals are not subject to Minnesota income tax. Minnesota tax benefits related to the plan are available only to Minnesota taxpayers. Senate File 1834 allows a Minnesota taxpayer to deduct up to $10,000 for a married couple filing a joint return.
Senator Clausen, is it a deduction or a subtraction?
It is an above-the-line calculation that reduces the income.
So it's a subtraction, not a deduction.
Oh, I'm okay. Sorry, Madam Chair. And $5,000 for other filers contributing to the 529 savings plan. There are studies that indicate that students entering higher education with a 529 college savings plan are more apt to graduate. And currently there are 34 states and Washington, D.C. have tax benefits related to 529 plans. And I'd like to turn your attention to the handout from the National Conference on State Legislators that I believe you have. And the handout provides a good overview of 529 plans and also a fiscal note that you should have has been prepared as well. Providing testimony today, I'd like to introduce Mr. Paul Cervenek, Minnesota Private College Counsel, and Mr. John McGee, Vice President for Institutional Planning and Public Affairs at St. John's University.
Mr. Cervenek? And I'm sorry, who was it? Well, just come to the table and you can identify yourself when you
begin. Mr. John McGee from
McGee,
St. John
Mr. McGee. Mr. Serbrennick.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Paul Serbrennick. I'm the president of the Minnesota Private College Council, which is an association of 17 private nonprofit four-year liberal arts colleges in Minnesota. I want to be brief, but I want the committee to know that on behalf of our colleges, I'm here to indicate support for this bill and to thank Senator Klassen for his work on it so far, to let the committee know that we believe this is a good addition to the work the state does to help make college affordable for families. And I would particularly like the committee to know that we think this is an important addition to what the state does for higher education, in that the financial aid programs at both the state and the federal level are targeted to low income and lower middle income families. And so many middle income families do not receive substantial benefits from the financial aid programs that are available. This proposal will help middle class families afford higher education by creating an incentive for them to save and prepare for higher education for their children. With me today is John McGee from St. John's University, and he brings a perspective of a college to this, and I'll ask John to introduce himself.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Mr. McGee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my name is John McGee. I'm Vice President for Planning and Public Affairs at the College of St. Benedict and St. John's University in sometimes sunny central Minnesota. In addition to my role at St. Ben's and St. John's, I'm also National Chair-Elect of the College Board's College Scholarship Service Assembly and will in a year become a trustee of the College Board. I've been writing and studying the economic and demographic trends in higher education for more than 20 years, and this winter completed a book on the economics of higher education and what they mean to colleges and universities across the country. Among the issues I explored were family savings for college, and unfortunately, I think the state of that question is not particularly good. Americans are notoriously poor savers, and even though savings rates in aggregate have gone up went up during the recession and since, they remain quite low, and I think it's more accurate to describe ourselves as a nation as a nation of hopers rather than planners. Nationally, only half of all American families indicate that they save anything at all. That is, they have money left over after expenses, and only 4 in 10 American families indicate that they save by intent. That is, it's not an accident. They make a conscious choice to save. In spite of the run-up in the stock market since its lows during the recession, only about half of all families have direct or indirect holdings in equities, and the median value of those holdings is quite low. Instead, most families park their resources or the resources they have in transactional accounts, which typically earn less than 1% return. Last year, fewer than 6 in 10 of all employed Americans over age 25 reported that the total value of their savings and investments was less than $25,000. What's curious is that about 6 in 10 Americans also indicate that they're quite confident about their ability to retire. We see the effects of that on college campuses, certainly my own and across the country. In 2012, Sallie Mae reported that savings and investments supported only an average of 8% of the total cost of attendance at four-year colleges, public and private, in the United States. And even among those with family incomes over $100,000, savings supported only an average of 10%. I think what's painful is that families subject themselves to the persistent myth that to save is to be penalized. But what we find on campus is that the primary reward for not saving, even though a creative accounting can help, the primary reward for not saving is the opportunity to borrow even more. And given that real median family income in the United States has declined substantially since 2000, the failure to save puts tremendous pressure on students and families to borrow even more. Incentives to encourage or induce savings for college can be quite powerful, especially when they're when they begin, when children are young and compound over a long period of time. I happen to be the parent of four children, ages 9 to 17, and in just over 1 year, we'll begin 16 consecutive years of college tuition payments. I have no idea where my children
will
go.
Lucky you.
Pardon? Yeah, lucky me. I did actually calculate how much that was going to cost and told my wife. She was horrified, and that was the end of that conversation. But I don't know where my children will go to college. I don't know how much grant or scholarship aid they will receive, if any, when they go to college. I do know, however, that the 529 plans that we established for our children at the time each of them were born has afforded us an opportunity to think quite differently about their choices. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. McGee. Ms. Pollock, would you just give us a brief explanations of how the 529 plans work now? And then I'll call on Gazelka and Dietzick. Ms. Pollock.
Madam Chair and members, the 529 plans are named after IRS code section 529. And generally the way that they work is that the contributions are made to a specified 529 plan, and then the earnings that accrue on the distribution are not subject to tax.
But the contributions are post, they're not pre-tax, they're post-tax.
Madam Chair, correct. The distributions are not subject to tax, nor are, I'm sorry, the accruals are not subject to tax, nor are the distributions subject to tax when they are made for qualified higher education expenses. Generally, from state to state, treatment varies as to whether a deduction, such as in Senator Claussen's bill, would be allowed and the amount of the deduction. And I believe a few states also offer credits for contributions to 529 plans. Minnesota's...
But again, Senator Claussen's bill is a subtraction above the line.
Correct.
Rather than a deduction on Schedule A, correct?
Madam Chair, correct. A subtraction for above the line, so it would go to lower taxable income, whereas a credit would be a below the line subtraction, and would just further reduce tax liability. And then, of course, with a subtraction. That subtraction is phased out as income increases because everyone's income is different, and so the effect of the subtraction is different on based on other above the line calculations.
And who is eligible to set up a 529?
Anyone?
Madam Chair, I believe it's a parents or guardian of a child who'd be attending college. I'm not
sure. It's also grandparents.
Grandparents, okay.
At least I know that. But I don't know how widespread that is. Senator Claussen,
yes,
can other
you.
Individuals set up a 529 on behalf of a child,
you know,
besides relatives?
We have some additional people that would like to testify, and I think they can answer that more in depth. We have
Mr. Cervenek or Mr. McGee. Can you answer that question? Who can set up a 529?
Madam Chair, family members, they're contributory. Anybody can contribute to a 529. I believe that you have to be a blood family member to set up a 529 in somebody in essentially a prospective student's, a young person's name.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Senator Gazelka and Senator Dietzick. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a comment to the testifier, buckle your seatbelt. I've been paying for college for the last 10 years for my oldest four. So speaking to this particular bill, it is for the middle class. Having gone through this, I realize you file it on your tax form, you know, so I've had two kids in college for a while, and you'd think that you'd be able to you get to deduct it, but the actual amount that you save on taxes is virtually nothing. So this is an opportunity to put a little away, to plan, because many Minnesotans, that middle-class Minnesotans, they want their kids to succeed. They want them to go to college. They want them to have a successful career path. And if they, the parents don't help and they don't get financial aid because of their middle income, middle class, then what are their options? And so parents in that group definitely need to plan better, and this is an opportunity to help them.
Madam Chair.
Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Office of Higher Education operates a plan here in the state of Minnesota, and we have Ms. Grimes and Mr. Helgeson that would like to testify, and they could answer very specific questions about the plan.
And we find out that anyone can open a 529 account, including the person for whom it is a benefit. So it's a pretty wide open eligibility for the establishing of the account. It's not just limited to relatives, although perhaps that is what is most common. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is for either the testifiers or it might be for Ms. Pollack or the Department of Revenue. So we just, in the federal tax bill that we, well, our tax bill that we just passed and the governor signed, we had federal conformity in there, and there is an issue with tuition payments, and I believe it's a deduction. You can deduct certain qualified expenses. Can you deduct tuition that is paid for with the 529 plan?
Madam Chair, Senator Dietzick.
Mr. McGee.
I don't know the answer to that question. The Office of Higher Education, Tricia Grimes, should be able to answer that question. I'm not a financial aid professional. I don't know the answer to that question. I'm sorry.
Maybe we can hear from your additional testifiers then. Senator Clausen, thank you very much, Mr. Cervenic. Mr. McGee.
Madam Chair, while they're coming up.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And also if the Higher Education Office could address the impact on the state grant eligibility of these resources.
That. Yep. So Ms. Grimes and Mr. Helgeson, is it?
Madam Chair, just to address Senator Dietzick's question, I believe that we can deduct now certain college loan interest payments. The interest on college loans, I believe, can be deducted on the federal and the state, if I remember correctly.
Madam Chair?
Ma'am, if you can answer the question. Otherwise, I will call on the Department of Revenue to provide some information as well, Mr. Cummings.
Madam Chair, I believe I can.
If you can just wait a second. Can you speak to this point exactly? Why don't you come to the table then just briefly, and then we'll get on to that point. Mr. Cummings, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Paul Cummings with the Minnesota Department of Revenue. To Senator Dietzick's question in terms of the tax conformity that was just passed, when this is money from a 529 is expended, it is not expended as something that can be deducted as income, so that they would be separate. Now, when in a 529, the interest that accrues upon the principal is also not taxable, but when a person is paying, say, $5,000 of income and $5,000 from a 529, you know, that $5,000 spent on tuition is something that's deductible as within the limits of what was passed in federal conformity.
Just not the 529 portion of whatever it is. Yes. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Ms. Grimes.
Madam Chair, for the record, Tricia Grimes from the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. Our office does operate the plan. To Senator Skoy's question of the impact on the state grant program, 529 plans, and I'm hoping my colleague, Mr. Helgeson, will correct me if I'm wrong, are generally considered to be an asset of the parent. And so there is some degree to which savings are counted as part of what's available for the parent to pay for college and therefore reduces their federal and state grant eligibility. However, by and large, the most influential factor on state or Pell Grant eligibility is the family's income. The formula taxes from 5% to 12% of assets that are non-retirement assets in coming up with the expected family contribution. And so usually it's the family's income that would make them ineligible for a state or federal grant. It's much less common for it to be their assets.
So I'll get to right back, Senator Scoy. So if someone else, like an aunt, has a 529 plan, that the assets that are in there are still considered part of the resources available to the parent. Is that correct in applying for state grants or Pell Grants? Is that what you're saying, Mr. Helgeson? If you didn't identify yourself, please.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Robert Helgeson. I work for the Office of Higher Education. My formal title is Audit Manager, but I also am the Contract Manager for the Minnesota 529 Savings Plan. In regard to your question, the calculation for how assets are factored into the federal formula, the federal needs analysis formula, technically, I believe, in reference to your question, Madam Chair, is that any of those accounts, even though it may not be in the household, maybe an aunt or grandparent, are supposed to show up as parental assets.
Resources.
Whether or not they are actually reported on the family's FAFSA is up to the individual family. Expanding on what Tricia Grimes said about the federal formula, this is one of the fallacies about saving for college. Many times people will be encouraged to put savings into their child's name, but when it comes time to file the federal aid form, student assets are assessed at a flat 20% rate with no protections, as opposed to anything in the parent's name. There is an asset protection allowance based on whether it's a single or married person, and those amounts can be $40,000, $50,000, depends on the age of the older parent. And so once those protection allowances are put into place, what actually happens is about a 6% assessment goes against parental assets. So it's actually been more beneficial, particularly in the case of a 529 plan, to have it in the name of the parent.
Answered my question.
Thank you. Further testimony, Ms. Grimes or Mr.
Madam Helgeson? Chair, we're here to offer technical assistance and answer any questions you may have.
Is there are there any other questions or comments for these two witnesses?
No.
Seeing none, thank you very much. I also have Mr. Straczynski.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bill Straczynski, and I represent the Securities Industry and Financial Markets Association. And, of course, we have hundreds of employees and investment advisors and programs, certainly in Minnesota. 529 plans, we very much encourage to support this bill and thank Senator Claussen for bringing it forward. I'm happy to answer questions. I just think it's an opportunity. I think what's really important for people to understand that just a traditional an investment, if you invest in a securities market, whatever, trying to save money on your own for college education or higher education, you may end up paying up to 30% as middle-class individuals for taxes to the federal government and some more for the state. This 529 plan certainly provide an opportunity to capture all those monies from those instruments, those investments, and make them available for education. And I can also tell you this, we are all concerned about, as in fact in my own situation, having now stepchildren into higher education system again, you don't want to put people in a position of having to take a look at their own financial future and their own investment strategy for their own retirements or what have you. You don't want to have people use those dollars for higher education because that leaves problems elsewhere. So we think this is the right approach. We certainly appreciate the committee's consideration of this and appreciate Senator Claussen for bringing this information and this bill forward.
Thank you, Mr. Straczynski. Senator Dietzig.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is to council. Is this scalable?
I'm assuming it is, so you can, if we don't do the full 5 and 10, you can adjust it?
Ms. Pollack.
Madam Chair and Senator Dietzick, yes, it would be scalable. I mean, as drafted, it's capped at $5,000 per individual or $10,000 for married filing joint, so those amounts could certainly be adjusted
reduced
downward.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I wasn't planning on saying this, but since Senator Dietzick brought the money issue up, the problem isn't so much with these credits this year, it's with the tails and the ongoing costs of them that we're struggling with this year, because our tails target is quite small for this tax bill.
So there you have it, Senator Lawson.
just to
thank
find,
you.
Yes,
thank you very much. I think you're very interested, but we do have the issue of the out bienniums and the ongoing liability and responsibility for these bills that we've been having, since they're not one time revenue losers. Okay, but thank you very much. We appreciate the presentation, and thank you very much. We know that you have worked on this a lot, and we honor that work.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe just one last comment. I think we all realize that investment in education is really an investment in our state. And we had a bill that we were hearing from in the Higher Education Committee, and we had a student that was testifying. And she made the comment that I'm going to school and I'm working so I can go into debt. Hmm. And that was kind of a sad commentary on the future of many of our students here in the state and how they will be contributing to our state in the future years. So, Madam Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity.
And I know, you know, the Higher Ed and Workforce Committee did make did a lot of outreach on Minnesota to Minnesota colleges and campuses, so that you guys went to them and listened to students all over the state, not just having hearings here in the Capitol and asking students to come here. And I think I've met some of those students, and they really appreciated being able to talk informally with the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It was very beneficial, I think, on both
indeed
ends.
Yeah. So at this point, the Chair will lay over Senate File 1834, and there were no amendments. Thank you very much, Senator Clausen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
The next bill up is Senate File 2057, Senator Chamberlain. Welcome to the committee. If pleased to hear your bill.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for allowing us to bring this important bill in front of you. What we hope to demonstrate is a little bit of investment will have help a lot of kids and prevent a lot of problems in the future. And Senator Clausen finished up by saying investment in education is an investment in Minnesota, and we'd like to think that, and I think what you're going to hear from these amazing people with their stories and this situation they face is that we have an opportunity here for a little bit of input to get a great benefit on the backside for a lot of these kids and families. So just briefly, last spring I was approached by two constituents, Rachel and Derek. They wanted to discuss this problem of dyslexia and some of the issues they were dealing with in education. So we decided to bring together bipartisan groups. Senator Clausen and Senator Kent signed in the bill. They were invited to meetings as well. So they showed up on occasions. We had people from MDE, and we also had professional educators who deal with dyslexia, have been teaching and dealing with dyslexic kids for a number of years, if not decades. So we came up with multiple solutions. What you have in front of you here today is one of those solutions. It basically builds on the existing education tax credit. What we're asking here is that we add on a tax credit to the existing tax credit, one that's focused and targeted directly at dyslexic kids or children with reading disorders. We intend this to be a bridge until the schools catch up with their development. And second, and lastly, there is a sunset to this bill. Ours has a sunset because, again, it's a bridge, temporary fix, to get some quick help to the parents and the children that are dealing with dyslexia. So, again, now I'd just like to turn it over to Rachel. She'll give you an overview, and then Jody has a story, and Jane is also an expert in teaching dyslexia as well. So thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Well, I just wanted to point out to members this it sunsets on December 31st, 2016. So it would only be available for a couple of years here.
Yes, yes, Madam Chair.
Which might want to think about that one, not doing that. But anyway.
Yeah, I have a couple of comments at the end.
But you were very conservative, as you usually are, Senator Chamberlain. So
yeah, try to
appreciate that. Welcome to the committee, to your testifiers. Who would like to go first?
I would.
If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, I'm Rachel Berger, and I
And you'll need to move the mic closer and,
sure.
and point it upward to you, if you don't mind.
Madam Chair, Rachel Berger, parent with Decoding Dyslexia Minnesota. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about our group and what it's like as a parent here. 45 million Americans are dyslexic. I'm going to pause and say that number again. 45 million people in the U.S. afflicted with a specific learning disability that impacts their ability to read printed words. Why is this number so surprising? Perhaps it's because, unlike other disabilities, dyslexia is invisible. You can't see it, which makes it harder to diagnose, but no less pervasive. And for millions of children who struggle in our public schools to read, it's very real and very painful. A lot of these children struggle with the shame and frustration of being ridiculed and dismissed in a world that has yet to understand their disability. They're often categorized by teachers, peers, and coaches as lazy, slow, stupid, or not working to their full potential. As a parent of a dyslexic child, it's heartbreaking to watch your eager, hopeful learner descend into an anxiety-filled pit of despair. Dyslexia scars and bruises on the inside. It eats away at self-esteem and confidence. Navigating in a complex educational system with a dyslexic child is a lonely, isolating path that more often than not denies our children the right to an education that actually works. Today, there's a common thread among families affected by dyslexia: a child who is loved, a disability that's misunderstood, unidentified, and untreated, and a strong conviction to effect change. We've united to form a collective voice to advocate for all Minnesota children struggling with dyslexia. Decoding Dyslexia is a 45-state movement driven by families concerned with the limited access to educational interventions for dyslexia within our public schools. And as Senator Chamberlain pointed out, we've been working with legislators since last spring, summer, to reach some goals. Our goals are to establish a universal definition within our state education code, mandatory teacher training on dyslexia warning signs, mandatory early screening, appropriate interventions, and access to assistive technologies both in the general education and special education classrooms. I'd like to point out some of the impacts on society. I think that you guys may have received a packet, and this is on the Impacts to Society page. There's a direct correlation between low literacy skills and crime. And on that page that I handed out, low literacy is strongly related to crime. 70% of prisoners fall into the lowest two levels of reading proficiency. 50% of our juvenile delinquents tested were found to have undetected learning disabilities. I just wanted to point out some of these things, correlations between dyslexia and the potential for crime or becoming an extra burden to our society in terms of taxes. As parents of children with dyslexia, our goal is to help to educate our kids early and to make good citizens of them, help them to contribute to society rather than the potential of them becoming a cost on our society. A lot of us were here today asking for your help because, we do pay taxes to receive a public education. Right now, we're working hard to ensure that our public education system can address the issues our dyslexic children have, but it's not there yet. And so we're doubly burdened by paying taxes for an education, but also bearing the burden of ensuring our children's educational needs are met right now. As they were talking about savings for college, I can't even begin to think about that right now with the extra costs that we pay for annually to ensure that my child learns to read and remains at grade level. So I'd like to also introduce to you a couple others.
Sure. Who's next?
Jody Stanton.
Hi. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jody Stanton, and I am a college student with dyslexia. I would like to share with you my personal story. My journey started in elementary school, and I knew there was something different, and so did my parents, but there was nothing either of us could do. My problem was nameless. It was everywhere, but no one could see it. I left elementary school not really knowing how to read and withdrawn from school. There was never once a teacher to identify a problem, to give a name to why I continued to struggle. It never got solved, never got fixed, and I left high school with a sixth grade reading level. Finally, when I got diagnosed, my life completely changed. Shortly after I got diagnosed, I began tutoring lessons aimed at teaching me to read. My lessons started with the basics. My first week, I was learning the sounds of the alphabet and adding new letter groups until I got to full words. This is something that every first grader does, and I was doing it at the age of 25. After that, I began to thrive in college. Armed with the ability to finally consume and process information, I was able to excel in even getting a 4.0 in college. But it wasn't without cost. One-on-one tutoring like the kind I received, while essential for my growth as a student, was costly. Lessons were $50 a piece and I had to go at least twice a week, costing roughly around $400 a month. I always anticipated college being a large expense, but adding an extra $4,800 a year for something I should have been taught in elementary school is wrong. It's not only an enormous strain financially, but it's a huge time commitment as well. I should have been afforded the same opportunity to learn how to read, and because I was failed by those who were supposed to be there to help me, I had to start over. Thank you.
Thank you. Ma'am?
Madam Chair, Committee, my name is Jane Conlin. I teach special ed in the public school systems. I own a tutoring center in St. Paul, and I'm a parent of a child who has dyslexia. Every day I work with and hear similar stories of parents who have a child who is struggling in school. I watch their frustrations and when they have exhausted their resources and the options available to them through their school districts and their child continues to fall behind. These families are forced to find outside help outside of the school system, and it creates incredible financial and emotional strain as they struggle in their efforts to educate their child. These families are burdened not only with budgeting time, 4 to 8 hours a week for tutoring, but also financially, securing thousands of dollars a year to pay for that tutoring. Some families have the financial means to provide that outside tutoring that will change their child's life, but many parents can't afford that outside support for their child. That child falls through the cracks, and they fall behind. Our parents are being asked to pay taxes to support the public schools, and then they have to pay again, outside tutoring, when the schools are not able to meet their child's needs. These families are being stretched emotionally, and they're being stretched financially. They are committed, responsible people who are struggling to do the best they can for their children. We need to support their efforts and the sacrifices they're making. This bill will provide some financial help to families, some who currently can't afford to pay for tutoring, as well as for the families who are paying twice for their children's education.
Thank you. Any questions or comments for the testifiers? And I would, direct people, members' attention to the handout that they did provide. I just want to make sure I understand, and I'm not unsympathetic to this, and you'll see that within the next bill, that we look at the expenditures that parents and guardians make for children with other learning disabilities, as well as dyslexia. We would still have, Senator Chamberlain, the definition of child, a qualifying child, be according to the Internal Revenue Code. So expenses that were for dependents that were beyond the qualifying child would not be included in this. Am I understanding that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Chamberlain and testifiers. I am sympathetic to this. I'll say something I don't think I've ever said publicly before. I had a child that was diagnosed with the inability to transfer what she saw on the board onto the piece of paper. We were told that she probably wouldn't be able to make it through junior high. I can tell you that as she was graduating from Hamlin with honors, we know that early intervention education helps. But we also have to be aware of all of the issues surrounding children and these needs that they have. So the question I have is probably to the educator. Would most of these children not have an IEP and be eligible for support through the school district?
Madam Chair, committee. The answer to that is most of our kids do not qualify for an IEP. They fall down in the area of the reading and the spelling, but they are so bright in the other areas, they don't meet the qualifications. So they are too bright in the other areas to make that gap to qualify for an IEP.
How do they get a diagnosis that they're dyslexic rather than something else? I look at what a parent or guardian would get a credit for, but I don't see any criteria for specifically for these of the students. I see what they are provided, but what if a student is not dyslexic? Or just the parent says the child is, as opposed, and then gets these gets a credit for these services. How would, and I realize this is, I don't mean this to sound harsh, but how would the Department of Revenue audit such a claim if there was no a formal diagnosis or affirmation about the a child's needs other than the word of the parent?
Madam Chair?
Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, if you look on 2.34,
mm-hmm.
I believe that starts to address that diagnostic assessments to determine what intervention. This language, we believe, allows for diagnosis and of dyslexia. So I think that begins to address.
So the parents would have to have some sort of, right. I don't know where they would get it, but they'd have to have some sort of a official recognition that their child did have the specific learning disability. Is that what you're hoping to accomplish by 234 and 235?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. And there may need to be some additional language there to tighten that up to make sure that the credit is being targeted toward those who are the parents that you're referring to.
Yes, Madam Chair, and we had to, that was some trouble we had trying to get to the right language while being too broad, too narrow.
We'll look further at that. Yes, ma'am.
Madam Chair, most of the parents, when they come to me, for example, at my tutoring center, do have a diagnosis of dyslexia. The other thing that we would be able to look at is these students are not progressing in the public school system. They are not meeting the reading guidelines, so they're already being targeted services. They're getting extra support, but it's not the kind of support that will help these kids learn to read. So they're getting extra support, they're getting the targeted services, they're not making the benchmarks, and they're still not making the progress. So there's a number of different levels that we can be looking at a child not making what they need to do and not being available for them in the schools.
But the services that this credit is targeting is for children with dyslexia, not children who, for any other number of reasons, and I'm not saying it shouldn't be including them, but for any other number of reasons are not reading, and their parents, maybe they were sick for a portion of the school year and they're behind, and so parents for enrichment or remediation would seek your services, but there's no dyslexia diagnosis.
Madam President, or Chair, Madam Chairman, I guess.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry, Senator Cassell.
Yeah, just a clarification too. I think for the accountability measure, the parent's still paying 25%. So I don't think they're going to pay that if it isn't a real issue.
Senator Gazelka, I'm not disputing that at all. I'm just saying we want the language to be something that when the credit is taken, the Department of Revenue can feel some confidence in what the law provides, that the parents are doing it according to this provision. And I do see that there is, any reading disorder on line 2.30, but it also says disability or difficulty that impairs a child to read and comprehend language and so forth. And I think we just need to be careful about who this credit is being made available to. That I'm not... not disputing it at all, okay? But I do Senator Squire, you have a further question? Because I have a question about the reading educator credit, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Chamberlain, or maybe it's been a while, but my recollection of the IEP process is that there, as you indicated, a number of scoring criteria. And I don't remember if it's 5 or 7 or whatever that number is, but the child has to meet, as you indicated, so many levels of deficiency. But maybe we could, and this would have to be an education committee question, I would assume, but perhaps if we're going to move forward on this, we should look at using that process but making it targeted toward the reading criteria that are in the IEP, because they have math criteria, social skills criteria, I'm assuming. It's been a while since I've done that, but perhaps we could target it in on that. But I think at some point we're going to need some mechanism for the department to ensure that, these are actually diagnosed and this is actually the recommended course of action.
Thank you. Madam Chair, we have one sheet.
Sure.
Karen has a few comments.
Of course. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Yes. Hello, Madam Chair. My name is Karen Martin.
I'm
a parent with dyslexic children in our public school system. My husband was diagnosed with dyslexia at age 42. He struggled through high school and then dropped out in 11th grade. There's a lot of dropouts that have struggled with dyslexia and not helped in our schools. I helped him get his GED when he was 40, and he has amazing talent with metal and building and 3D. But he's left with the belief that he is inferior to so many because of his not succeeding in his school days. Dyslexia is hereditary. 5 of our 11 children have dyslexia. As parents, we are adamant that our children do not struggle through school. They are tutored outside of school twice a week for an hour at each session. Only with this specialized tutoring did my children stop falling behind in school. The time it takes, as well as the cost, to have them receive this reading remediation, I can easily say, is a large burden to our family. But as of right now, not one of my children are in after-school activities, as you can imagine. But as a Minnesotan family that pays our taxes, we've already covered their public education costs. But to have my dyslexic children be able to grow into successful, contributing citizens, we have to pay again out of our pockets thousands of dollars each year for tutoring. This bill, as you can imagine, would be a big help to families like mine. I personally know, and I'm happy to be here today to speak on behalf also for many families that live in Cologne, Watertown, Montrose, Buffalo, Elk River. They're all in the same situation as my family and feel that this bill would be a great help to them. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. Any questions for Ms. Martin? Senator, thank you very much. In Section 3 of the bill for the credit for the reading educator, the second sentence talks about the individual claiming the credit, being a licensed teacher, which I think is a factor that you can give evidence for. But the credit is claimed must be through a program that has been field tested and shown to be effective for dyslexic students that incorporates a complete, and I think it's actually multi-sensory curriculum. According to whom? Who's going to certify that the program that they offer is one that is effective? I mean, what standard, or does the MDE have a list of programs that they think? I mean, I don't even know what you mean, but in a sense about effective. But does the MDE have a list of programs, or is there a national organization of dyslexic educators that certifies certain programs so that parents that go to these organizations to find a tutor have some sort of assurance that what or if any improvements are made that they come with a thoroughly grounded background?
I'll just say quickly that was a source of a lot of discussion to try to get this right, but I'll let Jane address that directly.
Okay, Madam Chair. What we do know is that we have lots of research behind the fact that a multisensory teaching will help the dyslexic person. It is the only way that a dyslexic person will learn how to read and spell. And the multisensory system that they talk about is called the Orton-Gillingham system. That's the philosophy on how to teach reading and spelling using multisensory methods. Of the systems that are out there, Orton-Gillingham will only let them use their name if it meets their standards. So there is probably about 16 specific systems that are available that are Orton-Gillingham that backs them, that have research behind them, and they will work to teach the dyslexic person. So as a teacher, if I have access to those reading programs, an Orton-Gillingham program, and I can learn how to teach using that and having that tax credit available to me, it's going to make it more affordable for me as a teacher to get that extra help to be able to help these kids.
I appreciate that, but I think that for the tax code, we have to have some sort of objective standard. We have to have that listed and not just in the eyes of the beholder there. And And I think that that can be easily achieved in amendment language. Senator Chamberlain, we do have a representative from the Department of Education. I wonder if you, one of you would step aside and let him comment. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Darren Cordy with the Minnesota Department of Education.
Mr. Cordy.
I just wanted to respond to your question that you had about whether the department would maintain a list of these types of programs which would be eligible under this. We don't currently maintain such a list. There are requirements that teachers who do instruction in specific learning disabilities like dyslexia are required to have in order to get licensure. Now, those are relatively new standards that are in place, but to the extent that they were supplementing that, what they'd be receiving in a traditional teacher education program, we don't necessarily have resources in place that would identify kind of what are approved or not approved programs by the department.
So we may need some sort of reference to a national standard or a national recognized certifying group rather than just making this statement is what I'm suggesting to you. And we can work on that.
Okay.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would agree. And those 2 points were discussed quite a bit during our meetings to try to get something that wasn't too broad or violated the ideas and
standards. We need to be specific, though, right. So that the it's like when people are claiming like the long-term care insurance credit, they have to say who they have the program with, and we know that you know that program is there, state how much they paid, and then they get a credit. And I think that's the kind of thing here. If the program is one that is recognized by a national organization, et cetera. And we can find that information out from you. Specific is good, vague is not. Senator Chamberlain.
Madam Chair, Rachel, did you have a comment on that?
Please. Madam Chair, we do have governing bodies that give recommendations for dyslexia. We have the International Dyslexia Association, which is a
national. Exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
We certainly can do that. And I think the difficulty you had, the question was posed, did the MDE have anything that they have as resources? Well, that is something that we're working out with them, and the difficulty lies again in we don't have a definition within our state education code yet, so we're working on what we can with them. But we do have access to calling out some of those national governing bodies within the tax, within the bill.
I also see in your handout on the last page of what you want to accomplish, and that obviously goes far beyond the proposal in this bill, but
yep.
Certainly are very laudatory goals.
Sorry, madam. Yes, we do have some long and short-term goals.
Right. Further questions for Senator Chamberlain or his testifiers? Chamberlain's army out there? I'm sure they're dyslexic parents of dyslexic children all over the state.
Yeah, just one final comment, Madam Chair. Members,
Senator Chamberlain.
I certainly do appreciate the opportunity to bring this forward to have you hear this. Again, I think what you've seen demonstrated here was that a little bit of effort and a little bit of help can go a long way to help a lot of people and avoid a lot of problems. I really do believe that. And, you know, fiscal note, I think, was fairly good in its estimations. And it's only $4.8 million. Of course, we'd be happy to bump that up another $1,000, which will only make another little bit higher. But it's a modest amount. And I'm hoping that we can find a way to help out these parents and these kids. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have one further question because this will, I think, also be a question for the bill that I have that's a little bit broader there. Mm-hmm. Do the services that you purchase, For those that are on flexible spending plans from their employer, which are tax-deferred dollars, do any of these programs that qualify for use under the flexible spending plans? And I don't know that we'd want to supplant the dollars that are used there if they're non-taxable dollars to this purpose. First of all, can they be used under the flexible spending, either child care programs or health benefits?
A number of my our families that are at my tutoring center do use the pre-tax dollars, the flexible spending plans, for helping to pay for the.
So we would want to make sure that it's one or the other, not in the language somewhere along the way, not both that it's pre-tax dollars and that you get the credit. I mean, there needs to be some recognition of that. And I do see that Senator Chamberlain, I should have seen that before, has accounted for that by saying that it's not compensated by insurance or otherwise, which would be the flexible pre-tax accounts. And they would have to indicate that as they're applying for it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, we're really interested in this and hope we can work it out.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Really
Further discussion or comments from the members? Seeing none, the chair lays over Senate File 2057.
Thank you.
Members, you do have the minutes from March 26th in your packet. Any corrections? Senator Dietzick moves approval of the minutes from March 26th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved.
Okay, committee, we have before us Senator Ress's bill, Senate File 2928.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I would move the A1 amendment, which is an author's amendment.
Okay, Senator Ress moves the A1 amendment. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, a number of years ago, I was exploring the policy of recognizing the it's a privilege to take care of members of one's own family, but it's also a gift to the state. Particularly with those that have some sort of disability or long-term care needs that they otherwise would be eligible to go to a state facility of some kind or a group home or et cetera, and that some families choose to make a sacrifice, I think, on behalf of the state by taking care of those individuals at home through a very loving gesture. And we looked into the possibility of the state recognizing that, not that they would undertake that care as in a kind of a but-for situation, but for the state recognizing their contribution, but that we recognize and value it. And so I had proposed at that time a credit, a tax credit, for caregivers who were relatives, generally relatives, of the person needing the care that remained in the home. We have brought that notion back with Senate file, what's the number here? With Senate file
2928.
Yeah. And what is astounding to me, and we also have another credit that for similar expenses for parents with children with other kinds of learning disabilities that pay up and beyond, again, their flexible spend, their insurance coverage for children with disabilities other than that have IEPs other than children with dyslexia. Well, what is astounding to me is a number of years ago with my first proposal, same amounts and everything, the revenue estimate was fairly modest. And here we are 5 or 6 years later, I don't exactly remember when it was, maybe 2008, and the revenue estimate has skyrocketed to the point where I look at it, and when Senator Skoy phoned me yesterday afternoon and said, guess how much it costs? And you know, I braced myself for the answer to my question, how much, and it was in the tens of millions of dollars. And what that says to me is, number one, in our environment, in this tax year, it's probably not something we can do. Even if we scaled it way back, and again, it's scalable. It's based on percentage of expenditures, on a limit per month, and so on. But just how many families are taking care of their needy relatives or dependents? Maybe they didn't start out to be a dependent, but became one. That Minnesotans have undertaken in the last half a dozen years. The other part of the bill, and so that's not, you know, realistically, that's not in the cards for right now, at least not in that vein. And I recalled with Senator Chamberlain's bill, the long-term care credit, which the House last year tried to remove and repeal, and the Senate resisted that, and we didn't do that. And it's just $100, and a lot of people spend a couple of $1,000s on long-term care. And it's not so much a but-for. It's not a but-for. It's a recognition that we value the fact that people are setting aside dollars to take care of themselves in the future, if indeed they do need long-term care. So it's a recognition of that for those who are able, rather than saying, well, if you didn't get it, you wouldn't buy long-term care insurance. That's not the point of that program. But the other part of the bill, and so just keeping that conversation in mind, the other part of the bill is certainly inspired by all the work that Senator Chamberlain and Senator Clausen, Senator Kent, Senator Anderson, I don't have his bill exactly in front of me, but those five people, those five Senate authors, well, who were caught up in the discussion of parents with dyslexia, children with dyslexia, to make them successful in school. And so the other part of the proposal also speaks to children who have other kinds of disabilities that are verifiable, that are diagnosed, and the lengths to which those parents also go to enrich and their children's lives so that they their learning stays apace with their fellow students. So I'm hoping that in the next few days we can look at those two parts of the separate proposals and come up with something that makes sense for Minnesota parents, that is verifiable, that encourages parents as they are able to take an extra step to provide for their tutoring services or occupational therapy or speech therapy or food therapy or whatever that goes beyond their insurance costs and the services that are provided by their school systems. So I really don't have any testifiers, but I do want to continue to work on those issues, and particularly with regard to the children.
Okay, any questions for Senator Rest? Senator Scoid.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Rest, I know we had this conversation yesterday, but I do want to thank you for your work on this, because as you said, I really think it is recognition of the effort that Minnesotans are putting into caring for their family, and we need to acknowledge that.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anything further?
Nope.
Okay.
That's it.
You wanted the bill laid over.
I certainly do.
Okay.
As amended.
The chair lays over Senate file 2928 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, the program for tomorrow.
Members, Mr. Chair and members, we have four bills in committee tomorrow. I'm blanking on what they are, but they're posted. So.
The infamous data centers.
One of them is Senator Dietzick's June Accelerated.
There you go.
You know that.
Okay, and I think that we're not meeting on Friday, or we are?
Current plan does not have us meeting on Friday.
So tomorrow, for the full committee, Mr. Chairman, at 9 a.m., and the agenda has been sent out to members. And with that, Mr. Chairman, you can adjourn the committee.
Okay. Thank you, members, and we're adjourned.